Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 113, a special episode in which we will examine a film through an organizational lens. The film is A League of Their Own from 1992, directed by Penny Marshall, starring Gina Davis and Tom Hanks, and produced by Parkway Productions. The movie tells the story of the early days of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, a women's baseball league that ran from 1943 to 1954. To learn more about the film, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, everyone. This is Pedro coming to you from Copenhagen.
Hello, this is Sarah from London.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And this is our annual foray into film. We generally do about one film each year and take that film and put it through an organizational look. This year's selection was A League of Their Own, which was from 1992, directed by Penny Marshall, and it's not a documentary. It is a fictionalized, but heavily grounded in the reality of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, which started in 1943 and ended in 1954. And what the film does is portray the beginning of the league, the first year of the league, through the eyes of some of its players, in particular one team. And the team was real, but all of the characters were not real in and of themselves. They were inspired by one or more actual personalities from the league. The league was formed in 1943 as an outcome of concerns that the Major League Baseball was losing all of its players to the war, and they were fearful that baseball would wither and die from a business perspective, and also from a social conscience perspective, because baseball at the time was America's number one sport. So they decided that they were going to open up or start a small professional women's league to try to keep baseball in the national spotlight. And so that's kind of where this movie begins, is with the announcement that the league is going to be formed. And we have various ladies recruited from all across the country. And the story itself focuses on two of them, a pair of sisters, who work at a dairy out in Oregon. They happen to be very good softball players, but they're pressed into service as baseball players. They're brought into Chicago, given tryouts, and then we follow them through the first year.
Two things that I wrote down in terms of why was this organization formed. So you asked us, why was this organization formed? And I think the two quotations that are good explanations would be from the commercial side. They said, so we can make a buck while the boys are overseas. And I think that theme comes up a few times, especially with Mr. Lowenstein's actions. You know, he's a sort of second theme hero in the whole film, but it is a commercial proposition. It is not a government entertainment organization like some of the offerings abroad are. It has to survive. It has to be a commercial proposition. Even one of the players recognizes this herself. Ellen says, if we don't have fans, we don't have a league. We can talk about that later, but there is a turning point in the film where the women take it upon themselves to make it more commercial, to stop resisting in very early feminist terms and to give in to the commercial side. But the other tension is, as with all of them, when the war ends, what will happen when the war ends, when the boys come home. And again, that's another piece of the film we can talk about. But they quote factual interview from Roosevelt, men's baseball won't be shut down. So as another answer to why did we start a second organization? Well, the president essentially said we have to.
If I can go back also to what Tom started mentioning, that the story follows these two sisters, right? I think that is interesting to say, just, you know, for those who have not watched the movie, although they all should because it's very interesting. A lot of the movie is about their tension, right? Because there is the whole story that at the beginning, the person that recruits them only wants to recruit one of them. It's the older one, who is perceived to be the more skilled one, right? There is also an element of beauty and how there is, it's part of, you know, the deliberations about who gets to play and how being attractive is important and so on. Run-of-the-mill sexism. And the other, the younger sister, right, also wants to play, and she ends up, you know, joining because the older sister says that she's only going to join if the younger joins as well. And throughout the movie, there's always this tension in terms of maybe the younger trying to prove herself and show that she's as good as, and the older one trying to navigate the fact that she's in a competitive environment, right, and she is perceived to be very skilled and enjoys that to some extent and almost take a sort of leader position among the team, at the same time not trying to or concerned with the fact that she may be overpowering or not allowing space for her younger sister to shine, right? So there's a little bit of that tension in terms of what it means to be a professional and be part of that world and also have emotional ties with the people that you are with in that space.
And I will lob that back to you as our resident expert on expertise, because there's a scene in the film where the lead character, the lead player, essentially we would call her sort of a player coach now, is sitting with the official manager talking about how they love their baseball, how they train, what it means in their life. And he says, oh, you know, you're one, the best player in the league. And she completely stone-facedly turns to him and says, how good am I? And it's a silent moment between them. He never explicitly says, you're as good as a man. You're better than any man I've played with or coached with. And they break that tension by doing the reverse and saying that she's terrible and she should be driving the bus instead. So I lob that one back to you a bit, because some of our conversation will be talking about profession, but I think a very interesting tension is also about expertise. And this requires a bit of background from Tom on the difference between softball and baseball, because they do come in as lady softball players. There is a focus in the training on teaching them to switch up from underhanded windmill pitching to boys overhanded baseball pitching. But I think there is an interesting consideration of how much skill they needed to show to get to the tryouts from the national scouts, which is still how baseball selection is done, and then how much expertise they developed along the way and what happens with that expertise after. So I will lob that discussion of expertise back to you, because it's your first time seeing the film and engaging with the topic. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on the expertise within the profession.
Well, I think I need to hear first this difference from softball and real baseball from Tom, because I don't know that, because it's actually interesting to watch the movie, because I think it's done in a way that even if you don't understand baseball, like I don't, you can still guess enough to understand what is happening. We had a previous movie that we debated in which featured rugby, right, in the past, and that was maybe that was a bit harder to tell, right? Because they use a lot of rugby to tell the story. This one was a bit more background. So I want to hear what Tom has to say about softball and all this difference.
And gentlemen, this is exactly how I feel it with poker films. So if we ever pull up a poker film on this podcast, I am going to need some hand-holding and some homework, because the tension in those films is always built with hands and bids, and I do not remember what beats what. I am terrible. So you are not alone in your feelings, Pedro.
This guy, actually, I have to start with one very important point about the movie, is that it was not intended to be an accurate portrayal of exactly everything that happened in that first year. In reality, the actual league started with softball. It was a softball league for his first year, and it gradually moved to baseball. So in the movie, it's portrayed as immediately going to baseball. And there's resources we can provide if you want to get the whole history of what happened. But the difference between the two, softball originated as an indoor form of baseball, literally. And it was a way of playing baseball in the winter months. So you could, you know, you could hit the ball inside the gymnasium. It wouldn't travel as far. You didn't have to run as far, but you can make it work. But it did eventually evolve into two games, one being slow pitch softball, which is a recreational sport played by everyone, and fast pitch softball, which evolved to become a women's game. The ball is larger. It is softer. Like a baseball, I would say, is probably comparable to a cricket ball. They're very hard. And when whereas baseball is pitched overhand, which is full force with the arm, softball is pitched underhand. It still travels pretty fast, but nowhere near as fast as it would be if it was pitched overhand. So underhand, you basically do a full motion with your arm. Ball travels generally on a pretty straight line headed to the catcher. Yeah, there are very good softball players that could put some spin on it, curves and stuff like that. But really, it's a much different type of trajectory that the ball takes. And the softball, when you hit it, it doesn't go as far. The diamond is smaller, but other than that, the rules are essentially the same. It is, you're trying to get as many runs as you can in the few innings. Running the bases, getting players out. I mean, all of it is really the same between softball and baseball.
So based on that, what, you know, comes to mind, maybe just the thing to say, right, is that we can understand expertise as legitimate specialized skill or knowledge. And, you know, one way to think about that is not necessarily as a pure cognitive individual capacity, but it's something that is an effect of participating in a particular system and ecology. So being an expert and being able to carry out particular work, having an ability to do something is an effect of the tools, the discourses, the roles, the situation, the context in which one practices, right? And it's interesting exactly that gendering our society prevents people from practicing some things or understand the particular action through a particular prism. So how much effort you should put, how it should look like, what is acceptable, what is kind of the practice you should make, and how would someone behave and conduct oneself, how one should relate, what kind of, you know, tools and ways one should aspire. So, you know, gendering also prevents not just directly to what you're allowed to play, but also how one conducts and behaves oneself, and therefore can gain skill and become an expert in one thing or the other. So that's what I had to say about expertise as a baseline for our conversation.
Yeah, and this is a good example, because I don't have any studies to back this up. Most women softball players play baseball really well too. I mean, they could out there and they would be competitive. Now the challenge gets to the distances and some of the speed, but mostly the distances, because when you get accustomed, I would imagine that if you get accustomed to running a 60-foot baseline to get to first base, it's very different from running 90 feet, which you would do in baseball. Or when the softball is coming at you at 70 miles an hour on a relatively reliable trajectory is hitting differently from a baseball traveling more like 90 miles an hour with a considerable amount of movement. The nature of the skills are very similar, but then when you add the context of what of the setting and the way that the games are played, the divide between softball players and baseball players becomes a bit perhaps more pronounced. But the women did play a very good quality baseball game. They were very competitive. They pitched well. They hit well. And in large part, their statistics, what statistics are known, held up pretty well. It's just that, of course, it was a completely different setting. And the shroud, you know, in the movie does depict this, the shroud of temporariness. The feeling like, how long is this league going to last, especially once the war ends, did put sort of like a, you know, it cast a pall over things, especially in the beginning when they showed that, you know, attendance at the first games was not really all that great. And there were questions, you know, there were questions throughout the first season. Was this going to make it? Was this going to be viable? The fact that they only went with four teams very closely together so you could travel by bus were various ways to try to prevent it from being so big and complex that it couldn't survive.
I've lost the number, but I was just trying to check average attendance at Major League Baseball games. So in 2023, according to Statista delivered by Major League Baseball, attendance at MLB games was 66 million, an increase of 2 million over the year before. So that's over the season. But I'm just thinking in terms of the dramatization of the empty stands to the full stands to the final game where the league founder and funder is finally there with his whole family in the special box. And because, and we talked about this once already, that as Mr. Lowenstein says, no profit, no product. So that's taking the background from confectionery manufacturing, the candy bar king as funding the league, and taking that practice into applying it to sports. So it's a different perspective on sports from entertainment to for-profit service. and I can't claim to know when that shift occurred. I'm sure my esteemed colleague would know a bit more than I would. But so that's a risk of any new organization, but it's an identified opportunity. And the window that closes that you discussed about what do we do at the end of the war? What do we do when the boys come home? It's not just what do we do with the women. So there's a conversation in the film between the promoter and the funder about how the language he uses is, do we tell Rosie to put down her rivets? The famous iconic Rosie the Riveter. Do we tell the women to go back in the kitchen? And you want to root for him. You want to be a feminist and say, yeah, you know, they can't go back in the kitchen. They must keep riveting. And Mr. Harvey turns around and says, do you want our boys returning from war to go back in the kitchen? Which I actually think is a very insightful recognition that this work exists. We've talked about this in other episodes about care work being unpaid work. Domestic spheres as organizations, leadership at home versus leadership in the outside. And I actually think it's quite an insight to say this work persists. Who is going to do it and what we value? And that parallels with another conversation that Dottie has in the film, that this is just a game. This game, therefore you could call it entertainment, therefore you could call it a diversion. This is not her main everyday. This is not her main ambition. This is not what her life, her economy is oriented around. She comes from a working dairy farm. She endeavors to have her partner, endeavors to have a management career of said dairy farm, you know, moving from the milking stools to the office. But that's her sphere of influence. And it's what she knows, is what she's good at. And she makes no secret that she wants to go back to it. So they do attempt to show it's a national conversation about what will women post-war be like. There's a radio segment with a moral agony aunt talking about the decline of women's standards. Women should stay women, which I imagine these days you could find some people saying exactly the same things. So it's part of a national conversation. And I think one of our answers, if we're going to come up with a set of reasons of why would you create a new organization, one of our answers we have to recognize is so you can close it.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I do think it's worth mentioning, since we're on that subject, there were some things that were not really good baseball decisions made during the founding, and one of which was the choice of the uniforms and equipment, which is worth mentioning because it's one of the things that, you know, today would be an absolute head scratcher. And by the way, the benefactor, Mr. Harvey, was fictionalized. It was loosely based on Mr. Wrigley, chewing gum fame. I mean, I think one of the things, you know, important movie decisions was, all right, we don't want to be too much real for putting certain people in a bad light. And so we fictionalized a lot of it. But one thing they did not fictionalize was the equipment and the uniforms and such. The women had to wear skirts, which is the absolute dumbest thing you want to put on somebody playing baseball, because baseball involves sliding. And as they did depict in the movie, there were a lot of unnecessary injuries brought about just because of what they were told, called upon to wear. You just can understand why somebody in that position would make a decision of that kind. They were so afraid about what was going to get changed. Like, they wanted to try to temper the level of change. It was almost like a timid move to try to do that. Because these women were working class women. They were not... They were very accustomed to wearing long pants or, you know, wearing baseball, traditional baseball type gear. This was weird to them.
And actually, that change is made very apparent in the film, because the scene where they move from full trouser and full sleeve, what are essentially boiler suits. They're boiler suits, they're farm working suits, they're milking coveralls. They all arrive to the tryouts with these trouser-based boiler suits. And there's a specific moment where they are assigned to their teams and they meet their coaches and they are professionalized in their uniform, as Pedro mentioned. And that is the end of Act One. So they put that in a very natural, dramatic position to say, you know, this is the end of Act One, that, you know, the trousers are gone. And the motto that it's actually really interesting because May is the first person to use this phrase. May is one of the home team, the Rockford Peaches. But in the very last scene of the historical part of the film, the Racine Belles bus has this on the back of their bus. And the phrase that the women adopted was dirt the skirt, girls, which was, as I alluded to before, part of their campaign to lean into the commercial appeal of the sport and the appeal to male game attendees, male ticket purchasers, male fans, male magazine buyers when they started being in magazine and print campaigns. So they fully leaned into that by making a big deal out of the difference of playing in skirts. But they did it by step one, making them dirty, which I absolutely love as a way of taking back a bit of power in it. They go from having to go to comportment classes and hair and beauty makeovers, and which, again, I'm sure Tom will tell us was all for Hollywood's sake, you know, but they go from being made into ideal women in completely feminized dolly dresses to making themselves filthy, bruised, cut up, dirty, as a way of, I think, taking back a bit of agency in a male-run organization for the male gaze. And I absolutely love that. And it was only watching it again in preparation for this episode that I noticed that it was on both teams in the end. So it's not just May and her hypersexualization and her tough history and her, you know, naughty Catholic schoolgirl persona. It's not just May. It's both teams by the end. Dirt the skirt.
So many great ideas here, but I need to just say that May is played by Madonna, who is flawless in this role. So if anything, you must watch us for that. And of course, she also sings the title song at the end of the movie. This used to be my playground. But I was just, you know, listening to you all, thinking about many of the episodes we did in the past, because as Sarah was saying, we talked about what counts as work is a matter of definition and social understanding. That was episode 111, in which we talked about the work of Susan Lee Starr and Alsam Strauss. There's a lot about gender and gendering and how gender shapes jobs and roles. It was the topic for episode 99. As we were talking about this, I'm thinking about change and how in episode 97, when we talked about Invictus that we just mentioned before, there it shows rugby as a mechanism of change, right? Because the idea is that the national rugby team was used by Mandela as a way to bring forward unification post-apartheid. So it was understood as a way through which one could recreate the symbols of a nation and shape it in a way that would promote harmony. Here is almost the opposite, because sport is almost like a consequence of a social change, a disruption, a shock, we may call, right? That the war brings, and physically, most of the men are not there, and many of the occupations that were usually dominated by men become taken by women, from factories to, in this case, the baseball, right? So I think it's interesting to show that this entry of women in such space was not necessarily understood as a mechanism or pushed out of an understanding about the importance or the more plural or broader inclusion that was possible for women and partake in different roles, but actually almost like an expected opportunity situation, right? So I think there's some of that. And that's why I think we see all of the debate on staying a woman while playing a sport and all that, are this whole idea about classes they had to take about comportment and how to stand up and how to dress in a particular way, right? Which I'm also wondering whether it is fictionalized or not.
It was not fictionalized. That was real. So, yes, there was, for the first two seasons, is what I understand, the full Monty was included. Charm school, they had to learn how, basically, upper class etiquette. They had to work on their posture. They had to wear makeup. And they also were, well, endemic with war information or war propaganda at the time. They were filmed. I mean, they were part of some of the home front news that went forward to the troops. So there was a lot of that was held back. But indeed, I definitely agree with you that you know, there was a contrast with Invictus because the president is using sport in as a means of change, whereas the other one is trying to pursue continuity, trying to make sure that there was something left to go back to, and there really was not much desire on the original ownership to keep the league going after the war was over. And yet it persists. And this is where the second hero character comes in. I'm sorry, what was his name again?
Ira Lowenstein, Mr. Ira Lowenstein.
Yeah, Ira Lowenstein. Yeah, so his triumph at the end, being allowed to take over the league and run it, is sort of endemic of the fact that the league did survive for 9 years after the war had ended. And its greatest year, you were talking about attendance figures before. At the peak, the greatest season, 1948, the total attendance was 900,000. And that was in like six teams, something like that. So, you know, I mean, a paltry number of games compared to what's played now. But still, that was an impressive figure at the time. We mentioned the Madonna character. Dottie was played by Gina Davis. The one character we haven't mentioned yet, really, the manager. The manager was Jimmy Dugan, played by Tom Hanks. And this is actually the first movie in which I remembered watching Tom Hanks. I hadn't paid attention to him before this movie, but he already was kind of a star. But this was around the time when he put out his really biggest and best known films. And he was definitely well regarded in this film, portraying the manager, Jimmy Dugan, who's supposed to be managing the Rockford Peaches during the season.
He was literally in Big with Penny Marshall.
Yeah. But this was much bigger than Big. And Big was pretty big. Yeah, I know. This is one of his best remembered roles, specifically for a very famous line that he delivers in one tense baseball moment. But it was really interesting that he was portrayed as a manager who was a sidetracked baseball player who lost his way because of alcohol. His introduction to the team is not a particularly pleasant one because he's drunk, severely drunk. And he's told that his job is just to be there to be a figurehead and wave to the fans. And it isn't only until his natural competitive nature gets the better of him does he start to actually reform and resort to really playing the role of manager. What I have read about the league, none of that. There was nobody who that was modeled after. The managers were all actually supposedly real gentlemen. Those were the male managers at the time. But it kind of made the movie a bit of fun because it introduces a neat little storyline, you know, a character arc for the Tom Hanks character to move from being a down and out alcoholic to becoming the successful manager of a team while essentially learning from the star player who stepped in to be the team leader and play the managerial role in the time because there was no other anybody else playing leader.
So it's interesting that you talk about him as a manager because at first I understood that the real manager was someone who is considered and labeled as a chaperone because there was this whole idea that the women had to be, of course, chaperone. They could not, you know, see men, they could not go out and whatever. And that's a great example of the whole gendering of roles, right, that we talked about in episode 99, that she's effectively managing these women, right? But because she's a woman doing the job, then the job is, you know, devalued and understood as not the one of a manager. And the one of Tom Hanks understood that is something closer to a coach, but that could be just because I don't understand baseball and I don't know exactly what the coach does or what the manager does. And he's not effectively coaching, right? He's really just standing there in the beginning, eventually she takes up. And what happens is that Dottie, the character of Gina Davis, who is understood to be the very skilled kind of player, she starts de facto deciding on who is in what position. And again, given my low understanding of baseball, I imagine that is a very important thing, right? Where you place your players and who is going to play what and when, right? And she does that out of just necessity. And as you said, eventually he takes or shares or kind of, you know, divide and becomes part of that role of the coach. But so it's something that was interesting to see that there was also this element of this, let's call it micromanaging, just because it was about controlling not just the work, but also the personal lives of these women.
And on the topic of management, so as part of the greater conversation of whether baseball is a game or baseball is a profession or baseball is a calling, the character of Dottie talks about her husband who's away at war and what their life will be like when he comes back. And his job is assistant manager of the dairy. And, oh, he's going to be a manager someday. He's really smart. And that's her end-all ambition for him, or his ambition that she is supporting. And I think it's really interesting because on the one hand, that's as far as her world extends. This is the first time she's ever left the farm. That is a good job and a step up from their current situation where they live. And there are different contexts where farming can be quite lucrative. You know, it's not at the moment, but they are some of the original family firms are big farms and like this. But it's also interesting in the context of what you just raised, because she's speaking to someone who should be a manager, who and all these men around her all the time who should be showing her what business ideals are. And she's smarter than they are. She's more effective than they are. She has natural buy-in from her followers instead of putting pressure on them. She has all the things we've talked about in our previous episodes, but without the title, as you said. But also, what is there for her still to learn from? In fact, to me, at the end, when her husband comes back from war, spoiler alert, husband survives the war, comes back, and there's a scene outside the final game outside the stadium where her husband and her boss, the manager, meet each other for the first time. And the husband is a big fan of the sports history and the giant that the manager used to be. And out of politeness, the manager turns around to him and says, oh, if you're Dottie's husband, I'm a big fan of yours. And then there's silence, a very painful silence with Dottie in the middle that the camera stays on for quite a while. And I never understood that in all the times I've watched it before, but watching it for this program, it reminded me of what we've already discussed today, which is the massive space between those two roles or those two types of men and how that will be post-war. And so those two lessons together, really, which is what is management? What is management in post-war America? Who is a manager and how do we train managers? We've discussed this once before, that that is exactly the right context that gives an uplift to a business school.
Yeah, I like that. I like that take. That was a scene that kind of went over my head the first time I saw the movie, but I, you know, I definitely agree. It was a way of showing the full arc of Tom Hanks's character, and how he ended at coming to learn to respect not just Dottie, but also respect all of the members of the team and to fill his role. Because one thing we should mention, why he showed up for the first time drunk, was because this for him was a serious step down. I mean, this was presented to him as a role to take, which was kind of like a last gasp. I'm here to give you something to do as a possibly a chance for you to redeem yourself, is more or less the way it was presented to him by the owner at the towards the beginning of the movie. And so that kind of helped to show it as a full circle. I've looked at gender and sport quite a bit. It's one that I've always wondered about. How, what point did we switch from men leading women's teams being somewhat of a step? I don't want to say a step down. That sounds so harsh. but as being lower status in some way from, say, coaching a men's team in the same sport, whereas that is definitely not the case now. I mean, and we can get into the modern, you know, the modern perspective of team sports and men's team sports and women's team sports. But there was definitely a shift in the attitude over time that has come that I think the film does a pretty good job of highlighting, was that taking this gig and coaching women was seen as a step down for somebody who's, you know, had better aspirations for themselves. It's definitely not right, and it's certainly not something that we would accept now, but it was just fascinating to be reminded of that in watching this film again.
So this is making me think of something Sarah started talking about at the beginning of the episode on responding to your question, right? What kind of organization is this? How it is created and so on. It takes me back to episode 104, in which we talk about Stinchcomb's idea of social structure in organizations and how when organizations are founded shapes what kind of value structures that they, you know, take on from the social context. And these things can have a very long life of their own because it's a sort of imprint, right, in which they operate. And it seems that there is something about an imprint of a manager needs to be a male, right? There needs to be a leader, and these people have to be managed in a particular way and micromanaged, that their skills is somewhat devalued. And I think it's interesting to consider that when Dottie, you know, the character of Gina Davis, who is this skilled person, who is de facto manager and so on, is selected by the person that is basically going around the country to find people. And she argues for the skill of her sister, right? She's always like, you know, pushed aside, like, yeah, sure. So there is a set of, you know, in the imprinting of this organization, there are many things about the ideas, about status, about roles, about gender, right, that are also imprinted into that. That would be an interesting study to think exactly how did some of these assumptions start to wither away and change? Because we may expect that at their foundation, given the context, the time and place they were created, that would be just baked into the way they operate.
Well, I think one part of that that we have not discussed so far, I won't say we've ignored it, is money. Right? We talked about how the league had to be profitable. We talked about how it had to sustain itself, as well as selling the ancillaries like chocolate and popcorn and beer, for example. But I think there's two parts to the money conversation that answer both of your recent points. So one is that there is less money going around. So for Jimmy, it could quite literally be a step down in money. I don't have the numbers to hand, but his role as a player at his peak with 4 World Series participations, then we're led to believe that there's 5 years of unemployment or potentially underemployment due to injury and then due to the secondary alcoholism to that injury. And he does talk about money in the film when, again, spoiler alert, the teams get to the World Series. He decides to actually read his contract and find that when the teams enter the World Series, he gets a bonus. So his transformation is not entirely altruistic, let's say. But there's money. There's money involved in everything. But there's money involved for the women too, which is why this is a profession and why this league sets up. So the scouts' offer to the new players was $75 a week. I can't say for certain whether they were taxed for their room and board out of it. Some women's professions that required them to live in a sorority type situation would claw some of that back, kind of like indentured servitude. Some of them, it was an excuse to pay them lower because the room and board and transportation were provided. But let's take it at face value that it was a salary of $75 a week. In 2024 money, that is $1,354 US a week, which is a salary of $16,248 a year. Not mega money, but for a woman earning zero as a family participant in her family's farm, and a farm that might see its output significantly constrained in wartime conditions, or at least the consumer base for its output constrained. Cows still make the same amount of milk no matter what. The ability to bring cash and send it home to your family would have been a huge appeal for these women willing to move to the other side of the country or move to the middle of the country technically. So we are talking about some money, and you can see from their actions that they do see it as a job and as a development. Many of them talk about how they will change their practice for next year. There's even a conversation between Jimmy and Evelyn, who is one of the more emotional, reactive players on the team, where he gives her his one and only golden piece of advice of what she needs to work on for the next year, which is almost an implied promise of reappointment in terms of fixed-term contracts. So there will be coaching, there will be off-season jobs that they can do, and a retry out for the following year. Once the league's status is confirmed that it will continue, you can start looking at how you would develop, which is what you do in a profession. You don't look at development in a job. You don't look at the next step or the ability to increase your wage. And again, that's the difference between Gina Davis's character and her younger sister. So in a way, they're sending two times $75 a week back to the farm in Oregon, one with the intent of saving it all and sending it all back. And the money is almost secondary to the activity, and one for whom this is a very professional mindset. This is going to be the rest of her life as long as they will let her.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.